emphasize April 27th. We have 10 bills, so we will limit public testimony in some cases, not take additional public testimony where we've had it before, and I want to be fair to people who have waited 2 years to hear their bills to be able to move through the calendar as quickly as we can. The first bill before us is SB 377. It's the mechanical code bill. We have had previous public testimony, and I would like to bring this to a vote.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Seekin.
I'd move Senate Bill number 377 from committee with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
Jane?
Yes.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Seekin?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
No. So on 3-1, 377 has moved from Labor and Commerce to its next committee of referral. That brings us to SB 369, University Student Practicum Liability Wages. And Senator Seekin, this is your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill amends current law by exempting the University of Alaska students participating in practicum programs from wage and hour provisions. It also provides certain protections that relate to vicarious liability. The bill's intent is to revitalize private sector involvement in a key element of the educational process. And the university offers certain fields of study which require students to achieve experience and proficiency in a real-world setting before a degree can be conferred. By and large, these involve medically oriented endeavors such as dental profession. Over the years, it's become increasingly difficult for the university to entice private sector placement sites to become involved in an internship program. Legitimate concern expressed by placement sites is that absent statutory clarification, practicum students could be considered as employees with respect to certain labor laws. But of particular distress is the exposure to vicarious liability. High costs associated with potential liability have effectively chilled the private sector's willingness to be involved in vital practicum programs. And this bill, Senate Bill 369, proposes a statutory fix designed to protect practicum sites interested in offering their facilities to university interns. The threshold requirement that students not be paid ensures that sites will not use practicum placement immunity to take advantage of employees who are also students. From a liability perspective, this proposal is designed to leave each entity, the university, the student, and the site, responsible for its own liability. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Senator Seekin? We do have a representative of the university here. Pete, did you want to make any comments?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, Pete Kelly with the University of Alaska. I would just punctuate what Senator Seekin said. There is a problem at the university. We have, about 5 years ago, the legislature gave the university money over and above their operating needs. With that money, the university went out and designed some programs that were kind of the hands-on training programs. Many of those, most of those, require a certain amount of unpaid work with practicum for an intern. Actually, what we're talking about is practicum, and I think some of the information that we pass on to the committee actually uses the word internship. But it requires a certain amount of hours of practicum be performed by the students. And that's growing. Those are becoming the most popular programs within the university. And now we're finding just as that is growing, we're also seeing some resistance from the community that would provide those hours, the doctors mostly and some construction trade companies are concerned about liability.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like a really good idea. Pete, can you tell us a number of students or a potential number of students, any idea what we're talking about here?
I don't have that exact number. I'm sorry. We do have, for just, Mr. Chairman, for any of the legal questions, we do have General Counsel J.M.O. Parrish is going to be online. I don't know if he's online yet.
He's behind you. Other questions, further questions for anyone on this bill, Senator French?
There's a memo in the bill packet. I'm not sure where it came from. I don't know if it came from the sponsor or maybe from the university, but it's a memo. Again, the legislature should exclude practicum placements, et cetera, et cetera. And it's written kind of from the first-person perspective, but it's not signed or attributed to any person. I wonder who prepared that memo.
That was an analysis, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kelly.
That was analysis prepared by our general counsel. That was an internal memo explaining the problem, and we passed that on to the committee. It is a little more generalized because I believe it includes some language about workers' comp, which is not in the bill.
Further questions? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. The will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman. I'd move CS for Senate Bill number 369 with the attached fiscal note, zero fiscal note, and individual recommendations.
I'll object.
Thank you.
And if I could, just for the record.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that students involved in practicums are working at the direction and with the close supervision of a university professor or teacher or whatever name that person might have. And if you're working at the direction and with the direction and the supervision of that professor, it stands to reason that the things you're going to do are going to be things that you've been instructed to do. And so if you're instructed to do something dumb or foolish or negligent, and someone gets hurt badly because of that bad instruction or your bad interpretation of that instruction, it seems to me that people shouldn't have to absorb that loss onto themselves. It strikes me that if a student, pulls a tooth under bad direction, or if a student, puts a sign up where it doesn't belong, or whatever, the hundreds of things that can go wrong, it just strikes me as being turning the world upside down to make a citizen absorb that loss when it's not that citizen's fault. It's the professor or the practicum students. So I can always feel for the university, but based on the fairly thin record we've developed now about what it costs them every year, how many students are not going to be able to be engaged in the practicums based on this issue, I guess I would say that they haven't made their case, and I don't think the bill should go forward. So that's my objection.
Thank you. Senator Stevens?
Maybe we could ask a question of the attorney. You say is available?
And do we have university counsel on line?
It just maybe Mr. Kelly can answer this. It seems to me, Senator.
Mr. Kelly?
Mr. Chairman. It appears to me, if you look at the at this sheet that we were given, it does say in the end, in response to Senator French's comment, from a liability perspective, the proposal is designed to leave each entity, university, student, and site responsible for their own liability. So liability is not being avoided or ignored. The university would still be liable for any incident that could occur, as Senator French mentioned. Wouldn't that be true?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. In fact, most of what the bill does is say that for purposes of practicum, they are not considered employees. So the university would be responsible for its negligence. The practicum site owner would be liable for theirs, and the student would be liable for theirs.
So if I can follow that up, Mr. Chairman, if an instructor would say, pull that tooth, and the student does, and it's the wrong tooth, the university would be liable.
The dentist. The dentist, Mr. Right. Chairman, I would think the dentist would be liable. If I may, again, our general counsel should, I'm not exactly sure why he didn't get through, but if I could just venture into that area a little bit from the conversations that I've had with him, is that if a student is hurt, they still have the ability to appeal to the board, the workers' comp board, and let the board determine whether they are employees or not. If the board decided no, they would still have the option to sue. But a liability isn't automatically assigned to the practicum provider site as it would be in an employer-employee relationship.
And many of these legal questions I would like to see addressed in its next committee of referral, which is, of course, judiciary.
And Mr. Chairman, in that regard, if I
and
could...
many of these legal questions would like to be...
I was going to say, in that regard, Mr. Chairman, we will be sure to do that in the next committee of referral.
Okay. That's what I thought you were going to say. Jane?
Senator French?
No.
Senator Sika?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator
Bundy? Yes. So we indeed will move 369 to judiciary. That brings us to a bill we have previously heard, SB 254, the tourism self-assessment tax. There is a CS, I believe, that I would like to adopt as our working document.
Chairman, I'd move CS for that bill number 254 version / X-ray for our working document.
All right, and we have heard this bill before. It is the chair's opinion that it does have some constitutional issues, and so what I would like to do is pass this bill from committee and ask the chair to give it a judiciary referral. And with that, Senator Seekins, do you have a motion?
I'd move CS for Senate Bill number 254 out of committee with individual recommendations, and
I'll object. Jane, would you take the...
Yes.
Yes. 254 is moved to, or I will ask that it be moved to judiciary. That brings us down to House Bill 29, Real Estate Transactions. We have heard this bill before. I have it listed as listen only. I do understand we have another amendment to address.
House Bill...
House Bill 29. We did address an amendment last time, and we'll move amendment number one for discussion and object for discussion. So
we've gone through two before.
We did adopt amendment number two, and now have amendment number one before us. And
which says what?
And I will ask Representative Roper to discuss the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Norman Roper, District 27 Anchorage. I'm joined by Ms. McConaughey as technical support here. Amendment number one amends the language on page 5, line 11, regarding by adding to the duties or clarifying the duties of a licensee as to whether they have a duty to investigate. It clarifies. Mr. Chairman, the amendment indicates that there is no implied duty to investigate a matter that the licensee has not agreed to investigate, or a matter that's not known by the licensee or the buyer and so forth. So it's just the new statutory language within this bill doesn't give rise to that duty to investigate. The subsection 2 provisions within the amendment indicate that there's no duty to disclose, unless otherwise provided by law, events. Otherwise provided by law includes the disclosure sheet or disclosure form, which every seller of a real estate, that means a home seller, whether they're represented by a licensee or not, has to make this full disclosure in order to market their home. But the duty to disclose, there's no duty to disclose events that have occurred in real estate that might affect whether a person wants to buy or lease the real estate. Mr. Chairman, we had some controversy admittedly in the House by trying to speak to the issue of what's called psychological impairments in the real estate transactions. This can include such things as illnesses, for example, AIDS or HIV, which is any indication of this is prescribed by federal law. We cannot, no licensee or seller can indicate whether there has been a person who has suffered from this grievous disease in the home. Other things under the, we even have a provision under state law in Alaska indicating if there's a methamphetamine lab that has been in the premises that has to be disclosed to the knowledgeable of it.
Excuse me, the meth lab does or does not have to be disclosed?
It does have to be disclosed.
Yeah. Could I ask this question? The duty to disclose, as otherwise provided by law, is any physical problems or limitations to the property. What this amendment discusses is psychological issues?
Right, in the main, that's correct. That's what we're trying to deal with. The fact is, if there had been a death, suicide, political activity, anything like this, ghosts, there's case law on haunted houses, Mr. Chairman. I mean, that's been the difficulty. Yeah. Is there, in fact, a duty to disclose that this house was haunted? Well, we suggest that there is a duty to disclose if you know about it, but you have no duty to investigate it and or disclose it. That's, I think, the distinction here.
So, for the record, you're saying that if the real estate agent is aware that there's a rumor of a haunted house, they have to disclose that, but they don't have to go around and ask if there's any rumor that this house is haunted.
It's a fine line the way the language is drafted, however. I don't want to give that quite a distinction. The way the language is drafted is that there is, it cannot imply a duty to disclose. If I might turn the question, the answer over to Ms. McConaughey here, if you identify yourself for the record, perhaps she could clarify.
Well, let me go turn to Senator French.
Maybe that her answer will satisfy my question so we can short-circuit
that. Do you understand the question that I posed, that if you're aware of something, even if it's a psychological nature, you have a duty to disclose. But this amendment says you don't have to go searching, investigating for some psychological impact.
Right, so where would you go to find out the answer, as, for example, the question of if there's a ghost in the house? How do you investigate whether or not there is a ghost in the house? Since I'm the one who originally brought this up within our committee, I could probably speak to that most directly. I found out, if you will, or there was suspicion told to me that there was a ghost in the house, and I felt it was my duty, and I checked with the shelter and told them it's my duty to disclose. Whether or not you believe in ghosts or not is not material. The people who worked on the house felt that there was a ghost, so I needed to disclose that. But then how do you, if you don't know that, how do you go out and investigate whether there is or is not a ghost?
Well, let me turn the question to a more practical. There's been a suicide in the house, and you're aware of it. You have a duty to disclose, but you don't have a duty to research whether anyone had took their life in that home.
Correct.
Unless it's common knowledge.
Correct, and one of the questions that was brought up during this whole discussion of this issue of psychologically impacted property is the gentleman asked a local judge, if I was required to investigate whether or not there had been a suicide or murder in the house, how would I find out? And the judge says, I have no idea how you would find out. And consequently, we want to be able to deal with that through this amendment, and then further through regulations the Real Estate Commission will write to further flesh this out, to tell us what to do, because right now we do not know what to do. We believe that it is everybody's best interest to disclose what we know. But if we don't know it, is there a duty for us to try to find out if it indeed happened, or if there was a situation that would be properly classified as a psychologically impacted property?
Dog didn't bark and you didn't know it, would Sherlock Holmes still follow the case? Senator French, did that address your question?
Well, I understand the answer, but I guess I'm still kind of stuck. I have reviewed, and thank you, Representative Roquefort, for taking up this question and sending these helpful documents around to the offices. I took a look at them. And I guess my question is where exactly does that come up? Where I have in front of me the residential real property transfer disclosure statement. And I guess I was looking through there trying to figure out where it is you'd tell a prospective buyer, hey, there was a double homicide in this house, just to let you know. And where is that in this document?
There is no question in our current form that specifically asks that, because right now we do not have anything on the book, statutes or regulations, that says you must disclose a psychologically impacted property or property that's had a murder or suicide, if you want to look at it that way. What we would suggest to the sellers that we believe it is in their best interest And I will point out that somewhat difference of opinion within the urban and rural areas. That's why we need some help in this as to whether or not we disclose that. But what we would tell a seller is in the addendum, which is this big, huge group of lines that somebody could write something down, that that's the way they would put it. If this bill is passed, and we certainly hope it is, with regulations written by the Real Estate Commission, we would once again amend the form and ask on there specifically if there's anything else, and the language would be written up by the Real Estate Commission that would need to be disclosed.
So the current form doesn't have it, but a new form, if this passes, would have something.
Yes, one of the advantages of having the form within regulation is we have an easier ability, if you will, to amend and keep that form up to date with what's going on within the real estate community. And that would be the vehicle through which we would ask those types of questions.
Just bought a house in October. This was the form we used. It's a great form. It's got a lot of information on it.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I'm concerned because the way I read this amendment is that it would foreclose that disclosure. The disclosure on the books right now in the regs, you know, right now it says disclose unless otherwise provided by law. That's the idea behind the amendment. But the required by law disclosures right now are very narrow. Those disclosures require you to tell, hey, buyer, you better go look for yourself to see if there's a sex offender living in the neighborhood. It's not my job to tell you. You've got to go look into that. And it's your job to go look around and see if there's any particularly noxious agricultural projects nearby. That's your responsibility as well. And so those are the two disclosures that I see required by law right now. And so I don't see a disclosure. I don't see any requirement that you have to tell people about a double homicide. And you guys are saying, well, trust me, we'll take care of this as soon as the bill passes.
No, yeah.
Or maybe a misunderstanding.
I might, Mr. Chairman, Senator French. You shouldn't get the idea. This bill does not affect the nature of what the disclosure statement is. You need to keep two distinct issues in mind. The disclosure statement applies to all sellers of real estate, whether they're represented by a licensee or not. So the bill before you only regulates the activities of licensees. So that's the distinction. The disclosure statement is for sellers of houses, not their licensees. So you have to draw that distinction.
Okay, I've got that clear in my mind.
Right. This is amendment, though. The amendment, and your question remains as to whether or not the provision in the bill here is this: you cannot construe a duty to disclose. So we don't want to create a duty to disclose that there could have been a homicide in the home. We want to restrict that. We don't want to create a legal duty to do so. The reason we're speaking to it is that the both statute and state and case law in the state of Alaska hasn't spoken to that. It's a field day for lawyers, Mr. Chairman. I'll just check. You're a criminal guy.
Or for real estate agents, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, no, well, but that's the issue. I mean, should there be a statutory duty to disclose some psychologically impaired event? We say that, no, there shouldn't be. And unless you were new of it, you don't have to have a duty to go out. I mean, let me just back up a little bit. The language of the amendment says you don't have a duty to disclose that or to investigate. One is different than two. So.
I think the big word here is you don't have to go out and investigate.
I agree with you, but that's not what this says. I completely agree with you.
Right.
You shouldn't have to hunt down the history of the property to figure out whatever happened there. But if there was a double homicide last week and some person just came to town that doesn't know about that, and everybody in town knows about it except for this poor buyer, I think someone should tell the buyer.
And
right. And I'm just trying to figure out where it's written down that you have to do that.
Well, no, it isn't. It's not written down, unless it's in the realtor's code of ethics, that it's the implied construed duty to disclose. We don't want to statutorily force the licensee to make that disclosure. We don't want to create an instance where there would be an injustice to even the seller of the house, on the one hand, or create this duty and then create a cause of action because you failed to disclose it. So we're endeavoring to immunize the licensee, frankly, if there was a failure to disclose or even if he knew that.
So I guess, I don't mean to interrupt Senator Stevens, but what happens if this bill passes and someone buys a house where there's been a double homicide the week before, you know, it went on the market, And, you know, this person buys a house, moves in, and goes, oh, my goodness, there was a double homicide. I don't want to live here anymore. What happens then? Can they go after the seller and say, hey, you should have told me? I think this bill says no.
Katanji, you might want to identify yourself for the record, too.
Peggy Ann McConaughey, I'm with the Alaska Association of Realtors. In point of fact, if that's the material fact of the house, they must disclose it.
Mm-hmm.
The question becomes, and that's what we're asking, is if there is a double homicide three houses away, do we need to disclose that? Or three blocks away, do we need to disclose that? And that's what we need the direction on, is how far away is no longer reasonable. It no longer is a material factor whether somebody buys a house. Also keep in mind, it is a material factor some cultures that they cannot buy a home in which there's a murder occur. That's a material factor that culture, but not to everyone. It's a matter of there is a duty to disclose, but where does that duty end? One block away, one house away, three blocks away, three houses away. That's what we need help with, and that's what
help
find for us.
Well, this says on the real estate, and I guess if you wanted to change it to say near but not on the real estate, I'd go with you, because I don't think you should have to disclose something that happened next door even. I mean,
but
to me, that doesn't matter.
The real estate regulations that will come underneath this will help define for us, and that's what we're looking for, is to give the real estate commission the space from which to write those regulations. Because I got to tell you, the way it's disclosed in Juneau versus Anchorage is different. I'm going to disclose it whether it's a block away. In Anchorage, they may say, heck, if it's not in this house, it's the next house. I don't care because it's a much bigger community. Those are the struggles that the Real Estate Commission will go through, and plus with the help of the Alaska Association of Realtors to help make good rules and regulations that the real estate agents or licensees are going to be required to follow. So I think this is the language that works perfectly.
Let me go to Senator Seekins, who might shed some more light here.
Let me see if I can understand it. In terms of disclosure, if we want someone to disclose it, we should require them to disclose it. What is not required should not be implied. And I think this is saying you can't imply some duty beyond what we have statutorily or on a regulatory basis required for disclosure. And I think that's what this is attempting to do. Maybe I'm wrong. It's just saying no one can now go to court and imply this if it doesn't exist in regulation.
The key words being on item two, unless otherwise provided by law.
Yes.
But I guess my comeback is that right now the only things required by law are pretty narrow.
Mr. Chairman, then if you want to require something different by law, introduce the bill. Otherwise, don't put...
They're already in the bill.
Introduce the bill.
Not so fast.
Introduce the bill and get the votes to get it passed. But the point is, to me, being a seller myself, the disclosure requirements are pretty well laid out in law or regulation. Someone should not be required to guard against implied duties. If there are duties, they should be affirmative duties.
That's right.
And that's what this is doing, in my opinion.
Exactly right. Mr. Chairman, Senator Seekin has it exactly right on. We have, even in the bill itself here, I refer you back to the material effects on page 4, subsection 4, where there's disclosure of all material information known by licensee is required. I mean, we have numerous duties of disclosure already enumerated in the bill. What we're trying to do is indicate exactly what Senator Seekins has indicated, that you can't construe this to imply that duty to disclose. Because you have the situation where, if we don't forget, Mr. Chairman, is that we have multiple, we have both buyers and sellers here. If you do something for the seller, then if you don't do it for the buyer, I mean, you have to be very careful about which duties any relationship, and we have multiple types of relationships allowed under the statute here, about who you're, what you're disclosing and to whom you're disclosing. So to imply that, for the courts to imply that there's a duty to disclose would be unfair. That's why we are codifying the duties here in this bill.
and I surely don't want to do the Judiciary Committee's work here. But do we have more discussion? Yes, it is. More discussion on amendment number one? If not, is there an objection to the adoption of the amendment? Okay. Okay. Jane?
On an amendment number one.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Crump?
No.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. So we have before us House Bill 29 as amended, and it does have an opportunity to rest in Judiciary for those who bill was noticed as listen only, and for those who might like to testify on further judicial issues or whatever issues on House Bill 29, they'll have an opportunity when it's scheduled in Judiciary. Hearing that, the will of the committee.
Chairman.
Yes.
I would move CS for sponsor substitute for House Bill number 29 from this committee to the overworked Judiciary Committee.
My stack is getting smaller, though.
With attached fiscal note.
Gene.
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. Move down to Judiciary.
Overworked. Hey, Mr. Chairman, there's a video.
Jane, the...
We will go to employment benefits.
Okay.
This one after that.
All right, thank you. That brings us to House Bill 305 on employment benefits. This is also listed as listen only. We have discussed this bill before. I did see the commissioner here. Would ask the commissioner to join us. And I've been led to understand that you have some additional comments to make about the bill before we bring it up for a vote.
Chairman, I'm Greg O'Clary, the commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and I have with me Bill Kramer from the appropriate section that has new information that we did not impart to you regarding the 26-week waiting period. I'd like him to address that. Bill, why don't you move up with me?
Thank you. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Kramer. I'm the chief of the unemployment insurance program for the state of Alaska Department of Labor. In doing some reading, yesterday, I realized that there may be an unintended consequence of the bill, which I'd like to bring to your attention. Last year, we denied 13,780 people who filed for benefits under the voluntary quit misconduct super work provisions that have been discussed here in this bill recently. If these individuals were denied 26 weeks instead of six, as has been discussed here, there's a possibility that the number of claims that are filed throughout the year could cause us to fall below the level required for the federal extended benefits to trigger on in Alaska, as they do each year. Part of the reason that we trigger on to extended benefits each year in Alaska is we have a high recipiency rate. Now, we can't predict with certainty whether or not extended benefits will trigger on in the future or not. There's a good possibility that if fewer people are eligible for claims, it could result in the calculation, in the result of the federal calculation, so that Alaska may not trigger on for extended benefits each year, as it has since, I think it's every year since 1971 when the federal government introduced the extended benefit. It depends on circumstances in the economy. I'm not saying that we wouldn't trigger on. It appears likely that we would not trigger on with the regularity that we have in recent years.
Now, you've said that some 13,000 are denied currently for 5 weeks because of voluntary quitting, refusing to seek additional work, or being fired for cause. And then after the 5 weeks, the people file and are accepted. So you're suggesting if they have to wait 26 weeks, they still, well, hopefully they have found work by then, but still a possibility they'd refile. But there was nothing that would keep, apparently having to wait 6 weeks doesn't keep people from asking for unemployment benefits now. If you have to wait 26 weeks, do you think fewer would ask for the benefits?
That's the part that's hard to predict.
I'm trying to understand that if that number that gets us to the federal money is because after 6 weeks they then get unemployment benefits, or is it that people would be discouraged from filing at all?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's the thought, that's the thinking here, is that it's possible that with a 26-week disqualification that it may reduce the number of weeks that are actually claimed throughout the year, and it could, the number of weeks claimed is part of the calculation that's set in federal law to whether or not a state would trigger onto federal extension or not. And so if the number of claims is reduced because of the extended deny period, then it's a fairly good possibility that it could change either the duration that we're on extended benefits or the fact that we might trigger on at all during any 30 years.
Do you know what fiscal impact that would be to the state?
During the last, 9 years, we looked at 1994 through 2002, we paid out an average of $7.3 million per year in expenses benefits.
And the other 47 states that don't allow anyone who's been who is out of work for those three causes, they just give up their extended federal benefits then?
It depends on the economic conditions within the state. Like I say, if this change goes forward, I would think at some times trigger on to extended benefits. Other states do occasionally trigger on. In Alaska, trigger on virtually every year during the winter period. Typically we trigger on in early winter through, say, midsummer, early summer, we trigger off again. Most states do not trigger on to extended benefits regularly. During this last recession, which exceptional, and we saw the temporary emergency compensation program put in place by the federal government. Even during that period, it was only a handful of other states that actually triggered on to the regular extended benefits program. I think it was 7. I don't have the exact number there.
Other questions?
I have a question.
I just want to bring the committee's attention to the charts that the department's provided. We had asked for those last time, and it shows the number of claimants plus those who were denied benefits. The denials seem fairly steady across the past 3 years. So those who have
applied for unemployment benefits, but and we're did receive them. That group has gone up fairly substantially. Questions? Senator Seekins.
Chairman, I guess I don't understand the federal extended benefits formula. What gets us there? Talk about the trigger points. What is the trigger point? I don't understand that.
Through the chair, Senator Seekins, there's three different formulas that are in place by federal law, and a state may trigger on to extended benefits by any one of the three formulas. The most common one, and the one that we generally trigger on with, looks at the they look at the IUR, the insured unemployment rate, that is what is the key number that's looked at to determine whether we trigger on or not, or whether a state triggers on or not. And it's calculated by dividing the average number of weeks of UI claimed for the past 13 weeks. So they're looking at weeks of unemployment claims averaged over a moving 13-week period. And that number is divided by the average covered employment for the past four quarters or the past year. So they look at covered employment in the state, which if I can look at one of the more recent weeks I have with me, was there was 231,355 individuals in covered employment in the state, and we had the 13-week average was 17,797 weeks of unemployment, and then the numbers are divided, and they come up with an insured unemployment rate of 6.56. While a state is over 6%, according to this calculation, you're triggered on to for a minimum of 13 weeks of extended benefits.
So if I understand this correctly, then the theory is a state that has higher unemployment gets extended benefits from the federal government as a percentage of those who are employed.
Yes.
So we're saying because we extend benefits to people after 6 weeks that are fired or refuse or that quit voluntarily, that we have a higher percentage of unemployed versus our insured employed, and so therefore there's federal money that comes into the state because we have what is a calculated higher unemployment rate.
There's a potential for that.
Okay.
To weigh in.
And how much, again, how much do we pay out in unemployment insurance a year?
It changes year by year. 2000 calendar year 2003 was a high year, and there were two federal extension programs on. And during 2003, there was $174 million paid out.
$174 million and about?
That includes federal funds. That includes the temporary extended unemployment compensation, which was 100% federally funded benefits, and that was simply turned on by Congress. No trigger. It was just nationally they turned that on, and then at the same time we were triggered on to regular extended benefits. So we had two federal extensions going simultaneously.
And that was how much that triggered on? How much was that was triggered on, you said?
Not the special.
How much federal funds did we get in because of that? We triggered that. I'm just trying to get
about $10 million in regular extended benefits that was paid.
just trying to get a rough number.
There was about, there was about $10 million in regular extended benefits program that we've been discussing here today that was paid. And there was about $40 million in the temporary extension program that Congress turned on.
And what was the state share of the total 100 and plus million that you mentioned?
134. So 134?
On the temporary extended program,
the state. What would the state have paid if we had no federal dollars coming in?
We would have paid out, if we had no federal dollars coming in, about $130 million. I wouldn't get these.
So we pay $130 to get the additional $40 million.
Well, it's been additional, $40
million.
That's what I was trying to get to.
Thank you. Have you given any thought if 26 weeks might trigger us over this edge, is there something more than 6 but less than 26 that wouldn't trigger us?
Chairman, the challenge is trying to guess what people will do under the new rules. It's why I apologize, I can't be more definite. Will some people stay employed because the penalty is now stiffer? Will some people find other ways to maintain their well-being when they're unable to get unemployment benefits? Will they stay? It's hard to predict, and so a lesser number of weeks of denial would, I think, make the scenario not triggering on to extended benefits less likely. You know, if it was a shorter duration, it would be likely that more people would stay and potentially draw some benefits, but we just can't give you a good answer.
Interesting catch-22. If we encourage more people to stay employed, we will get less federal extended benefits, but then we'll have less need of them as well.
If I may, sir, yes. One interesting side note is today, people who are denied under the current 6-week provision, the law the way it is today, they are prevented from receiving any extended benefit.
Ever.
For a benefit year.
Okay. Well, that begs to be asked, of course, is if we deny unemployment benefits to someone, what does this do to the state's welfare rolls and the costs there? This bill seems to have some finance questions, and it'd be the chair's desire to move it to its next committee, which is finance.
Mr. Chairman, you're sure it's not going judiciary?
I'm absolutely positive.
All right. In that case, Mr. Chairman, I'd move, what was the number of this in Senate bill, number 305, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
It's home and finance.
You didn't ask for that bill.
Senator Stevens.
Yes.
Senator French.
Yes.
Senator Speakin.
Yes.
Senator Bundy.
Yes. 305 is on its way to finance, and the other broad-shouldered Fairbanks person.
Yeah, right.
That would bring us to
339.
Representative Meyer. Ah, there you are. No hiding. So you want this bill to pass, or would you rather talk about it?
No. This is a finance.
It's a finance.
No, this is the first time we've heard this bill, so really would like to.
It's your file.
It actually is. Or it goes to judiciary next, yeah. So. thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, moving 2 years in a little faster than I thought. I was up in the House Finance,
Appreciate you joining us.
Yes, thank you, and thanks for hearing our bill today. Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce, this bill is truly a consumer protection bill, and it has two distinct marketing practices that I'm going to talk about as it pertains to businesses. The first is the free trial period, and the second is the opt-out marketing program. The free trial period, it pertains to, you've probably all seen this before, magazines that offer you to use their magazine for 30 days, and then if you like it, then they start billing you for it. Well, unfortunately, it's not always clear after that free trial period as to what your obligations are. And so what this bill is going to do is going to require that the seller clearly disclose all the material terms and all the conditions of the free trial period. And any obligations that you have as the user of the product during that free trial period. And it also describes the charges and how the charges are going to be made after you've used the product during this free trial period. So in other words, what it's going to do is going to shift the burden on to the business to prove that they fully disclosed all of the requirements and obligations of you using their product during this free trial period so that there's no surprises. The second part is the opt-out marketing plan, and this actually is why I came forward with this bill. Some of you may remember last year, some of the telecommunication companies were offering these free service, or the, a service on your cell phone, and unless you opted out, you automatically got charged for it. Well, a lot of my constituents are upset, and I think some of yours probably too, that, you know, this isn't fair. Why is it I'm being stuck with this, and then now I have to opt out of it? And I don't know if you've ever tried to opt out of something, but sometimes that 1-800 number, you can be on eternal hold. So it's very frustrating for the buyer. And I think it's also very, it's an unfair practice in the sense too that I think many people are vulnerable, especially your older people who all of a sudden receive this good or service and they think they might have ordered it, or people like ourselves who are extremely busy and you see this $4 charge on your credit card and you think, yeah, I should, you know, call and get that taken off, but it's just such a small amount, I'm going to keep it. So businesses use this as an effective marketing tool to get their product out to people, and a lot and they rely on people not opting out, and so they are able to make a lot of business that way. But Mr. Chairman, this bill is saying that that's not fair. We want the businesses to disclose everything that is involved with the opt-out program. And what this bill will do is it prohibits the use of the opt-out marketing plan unless disclosures are made to people ahead of time. Again, it removes any uncertainty in the statute. The statute is kind of unclear as it pertains to these type of practices, and it places all the responsibility again on the business to prove that they made the full and adequate disclosures to the buyer or consumer ahead of time. We've been working really close with the Department of Law on this, as they have had several complaints about these particular practices. Ed Smithen has been online through the various committee process. I don't know if he's with us today.
Chair, note that Cynthia Drinkwater is online and I believe would like to comment.
Very good. Then I think I'll leave my comments there, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Representative Meyer before we go to Ms. Drinkwater? We'll move on to Ms. Drinkwater then. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
We hear you just fine. Would you like to comment on House Bill 339?
Actually, I don't think I need to testify. I think Representative Myers gave a very accurate summary of the purpose of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Questions for Ms. Drinkwater? Assume you are in support of the bill.
That's correct. We are.
Okay, thank you. We'll go on then to Virginia Torrens, I believe, who wanted to comment. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were on. May we hear from Virginia, please? Excuse me. We get so few real people instead of disembodied voices.
My name is Virginia Tornes. I'm with Alaska Public Interest Research Group. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to let you know that ACPERG is in support of House Bill 339 because we believe it will better protect consumers in Alaska. the negative option plan or opt-out plans have often been used to trap consumers in the purchasing of goods or services simply because the consumer did not check a box or send back the appropriate form. And this is especially true of free trial offers where consumers let their guards down to receive something for free and end up paying for something they do not want. House Bill 339 will require more disclosure on the part of companies doing this sort of business, including the charges for purchases, shipping and handling, and other obligations the consumer has. The seller also has to clearly disclose how the consumer can get out of free trial membership. While opt-out plans are always preferable, opt-in plans are always preferable to opt-out deals, House Bill 339 will add to the consumer protection here in Alaska, and this is why we adamantly support this bill.
Questions? Thank you for your testimony. I would call the committee's attention also to a letter we have from AARP that is supportive of the bill. Do we have additional questions for Representative Meyer? Anyone else would like to testify on House Bill 339? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. You did have those six amendments, is that right?
I do right here. Mr. Chairman?
Having no amendments, Senator Seekin.
Mr. Chairman, I tell you, I inherently dislike opt-out programs. I think they ought to be flat-out illegal. And on that basis, in fact, I will move that we move this House Bill 339 out of committee with individual recommendations and pistol notes.
Even if it goes to judiciary. Well, this, in fact, will make them illegal. And so, Jane?
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Prince?
Yes.
Senator
Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. We have moved 339 on, and that would bring us to House Bill 549 on solicited communication aircraft crash, and we are awaiting the bill sponsor arrival.
I'll be right back.
Okay. We will stand briefly at ease. Okay, and we have heard before the unsolicited communication, and we have a representative, the bill sponsor. Do you have some comments you'd like to make?
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Vanessa Kennedy, staff person, and the Judiciary Committee. And just to give you a little background on this bill, it's one you should all enjoy, getting to regulate ambulance-chasing lawyers. And normally, people such as that are, and they currently are, governed by the Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct. The issue in particular we're dealing with now has to do with Rule 7.3, the Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct, which states that an attorney shall not solicit by in-person or live telephone contact professional employment from a prospective client with whom the lawyer has no family or prior professional relationship when a significant motive for the lawyer's doing so is the lawyer's pecuniary gain. And the reason for this rule is that a prospective client who may already feel overwhelmed by circumstances giving rise to their need for legal services may find it difficult to fully evaluate all their alternatives and that sort of thing when they're faced with a difficult situation after an accident or something giving rise to the need for legal representation. So even though this rule and rules like it have been in place across the nation for some time, they haven't controlled the problem that's been taking place in Alaska in the aftermath of aviation accidents. And the federal government tried to correct this problem when it recognized the vulnerability of aviation accident victims and their families in 1996 when it passed the federal law, the Aviation Disaster Family Assistance Act. And that federal law mandated that air carrier providers, or they said they provide specific support to families of those that were injured or killed, in an accident and also prohibited unsolicited contact by attorneys with these individuals for 30 days. And in 2000, the law was amended to expand the scope of unsolicited contact to include any associate, agent, employee, or other representative of the insurer, and expanded the time from 30 to 45 days. And the reason why we're here today is the enforcement of this law requires action by the Civil Aeronautics Board and the U.S. Attorney General, and the penalty for violation is just a mere $1,000 fine, and there's very little enforcement of the law. And there's also some legal debate as to whether or not the federal law is enforceable against attorneys who violate it in the context of aviation accidents involving flights entirely within Alaska. So, considering that people who have been involved or their families have in an aviation accident, like I said, especially in rural Alaska, they're isolated initially from all the necessary support services, and we don't want them to be preyed upon by not good lawyers, in other words, until they themselves decide that it's time to initiate that process. So HB 549 was based on the federal law, and we felt this law was necessary because it needs to apply to flights that take place within Alaska. And like the federal law, it doesn't interfere with the performance of the family support functions provided for in the Family Assistance Act by the air carriers and its insurer. And also 549, in our bill, we made it clear that we don't want any attorneys to contact these people, so we added a reference to the air carrier's attorney as well. And regarding the sanctions against attorneys, we felt that a civil financial penalty is inadequate because the financial incentive of representing an aircraft accident victim could be so great that they'd almost be willing to take the financial fee of $1,000 if they're getting a multi-million dollar payment out of this. So we felt a criminal sanction would be the best deterrent, and I could go into detail now. We do have a blank CFS for you.
I wanted to ask about that, if we could adopt that CS and then use this as the basis of our discussion.
Senator, if you can. Mr. Chairman, I'd move set a CS for CS House Bill 549 / I for India as our working document.
Without objection, that will be our working document. Now, if you would address CS, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And I apologize for coming before the Senate with a blank CS. With work that arguably could have and should have been done in the House. It's as a result of a few last-minute floor amendments, which often happens, we then looked back through the bill and found some conforming minor changes that had to take place.
We in the Senate don't mind doing cleanup after the House.
Doing our cleanup. what we have here, I prepared a memo also that which, if members don't have, I'd be happy to distribute.
Call a committee member's attention to this memo? Is that
the truth? Yes, the memo dated today explaining what the blank CS does and what areas it addresses. So if you do have any specific questions, refer back to this. But basically, subsection B of this bill, which is page 1, lines 12 through 15, was added on the floor of the House, clarifying that during this 45-day period following an aircraft accident, neither an agent nor a representative of the air carrier or its insurer may not initiate contact for the purpose of offering a final settlement. There was concern that they wanted to make sure that no talk of offering a final settlement was allowed to take place. So we didn't object to that. That is not the purpose of this bill, and the sponsor does not intend for it. So that subsection was added on the floor. And then as a result, just to sort of clarify, we wanted to have, under the federal law and also just in general, the air carrier may have obligations that it has to do support services, that's like providing short-term financial assistance. They might have a duty to do that. So we wanted to make it clear on page 2, we just added in a reference in subsection C that the prohibitions that we established in this bill do not apply to the activities that an air carrier or its insurers may undertake or may have to to provide assistance to these passengers. So that's just sort of a clarifying amendment. And also we added in subsection 2 there, just clarifying that they might have obligations under the Aviation Disaster Family Assistance Act that they might have to comply with. And then the other area of the bill that was amended in the House was the removal of, in subsection D, the penalty section, which is page 2, lines 8 through 12. On the floor, the language upon conviction is punishable only by a fine of $10,000 for the first offense and $100,000 for a second offense. That's how the bill originally read, and that language was removed. And what's problematic about that is when it's not specified that there's a financial, a monetary fine, then that would then allow a judge to impose a term of imprisonment, which was never the intent of the sponsor. Although we felt a criminal penalty was necessary, we didn't think that going down the road of treating these attorneys as criminals in the jail sense was necessary. We just wanted to put a substantial enough financial, you know, penalty in place. So that's why the new language is there. And throughout working with several members of the House and the bill sponsor, we came up with the great idea of imposing a very harsh fine, making it a Class A misdemeanor, so sticking with that, but then also saying the fine is $100,000 or what fee that the attorney would receive if they did actually get this representation through a violation of this bill. So basically taking away any incentive for them to pursue these people in violation of this bill. And the only other handwritten change that was made to the CS, and this is up to your discretion. Last minute, there were some people that felt that contact in subsection E, which is handwritten on page 2 of the CF, some felt that contact needed to be defined in the bill. And the bill sponsor, Representative McGuire, and the House Judiciary Committee is hesitant to do that. We're not opposed to it, but we want to make sure it's done right. So if, Mr. Chairman, you feel that you just want to strike that section right now, and I think next we'll be visiting Senator Sinkins in Senate Judiciary, we could take it up at that time and give us more time to craft the definition or decide it's not necessary at all. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, and we should have...
I do have a couple of questions. One is about the fine. You know, I'm a kind of a lock-em-up, throw-away-the-key sort of guy, but I understand that there are some limitations in law called proportionality, and this is a judiciary question, but just for my own curiosity, would the amount of the fine be accepted by the courts as a just fine based on the the severity of the crime?
Well, Chairman Bundy, we hope so. I mean, in our current criminal statutes, I'm trying to, I think I printed out a copy, and if I don't have it here, I apologize. But yes, it's in Alaska Statute 1255.035, the maximum fines are set out for each level of crime. And ordinarily, the maximum fine for a Class A misdemeanor is $10,000. But there is a provision which allows the legislature to establish otherwise for a crime that they feel they want to slap
on. The entry cost is the same. All right, thank you. And the other is a good idea about not making people make decisions about legal representation when they're in a state of stress. But why do you limit it only to aircraft accidents? Why wouldn't it apply to automotive accidents, bus and train?
Mr. Chairman, I feel that this should be the policy throughout all, and it is to the extent that the Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct govern. So all attorneys in any situation are prohibited from soliciting this type of communication. In the aftermath of an accident, they don't go into this grade of specificity as they felt after an aircraft accident. I think just because of the large number of people affected, and I mean, versus just a small, you know, automobile accident or something, I mean, the federal government thought it was necessary to regulate this more in detail.
Because the damage or the recovery
is potentially much larger than in your average automobile accident?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Questions? Senator Stevens.
Is there any reason why in subsection D you did not put in fine equal to the greater of 100,000 or the fees for representing a party, whichever is greater, or you just wanted to let the court have the discretion? Fee could have been 20,000. Are you going to let the court decide that, or are you going to try to go for whichever is greater? How are you going to, how did you mean to do that?
Well, through the chair, Senator Seekins, we attempted, I believe on page 2, line 9, we attempted to say that it shall be sentenced
to the greater of, okay.
To the greater of 1,000.
The minimum of 100,000.
Gotcha.
So, yeah. So okay. The judge would have discretion, whichever.
Other questions? Senator French.
Just to follow up on the chairman's question, I thought it was a good question. I guess I have a hard time differentiating in my mind between someone who's in the World Trade Center tower and someone who's in a plane crashing into the World Trade Center. I guess I'm not sure which family is more grievously wounded or injured or incapable of making a decision. So I guess I share the chairman's concern that we're focusing on air carriers. But that's kind of a subsidiary concern. The other issue I have is about the penalty for lawyers who break the professional rules. I don't know if, I'll just say this. You know, a lawyer's ticket to practice law is immensely valuable. I mean, you can't put a value on it. If you lose your ticket to practice, you have to go find another line of work. And lawyers are probably only capable of, like, washing dishes or something if they lose their law ticket. I mean, what are they going to do?
There's always a legislative career.
It's only part-time.
Yeah, that's true.
So it strikes me that there's a pretty good mechanism in place right now for dealing with this. And I guess my real question is there must be some pretty serious violations of this policy happening right now. And I'm hoping you're going to bring us some really, you know, hair-curling stories about the terrible things the lawyers have done to plane crash victims here in the state.
We have a couple of people to testify that might help along those lines. Did you wish to respond?
Through the chair, Senator French. I mean, to address your first point, or the first subsidiary point you made, I agree with you. I mean, I don't think that no matter what side you're on or however you're involved in an awful tragedy or an accident such as this is any more or less deserving of grief, you know, and I don't think this bill attempts to even give more weight to one side or the other, and in fact it tries to equate, you know, whatever side the attorney is representing. And this bill solely attempts to get at the attorney, not, you know, the attorney's bad conduct. It doesn't change the grief or, you know, the treatment given to victims. So that's the first point. And then secondly, you know, it's a shame. You'd think that the Alaska Rules of Professional Conduct would be enough of a, you know, guideline for attorneys to live by, and the threat of having their license taken away. You'd think that that would be enough, but apparently in rural Alaska, it's not, or even in cities in Alaska, it's just not being enforced. And I do think there are people online that could expand upon how it's been in violation.
Before we go to public testimony, I too think I'd rather have more thoughtful amendments than the handwritten section, and would entertain a motion to delete this from the CS. So we have moved to delete section E, the handwritten section, from the CS for 549 that we have adopted without objection. Okay. If with the committee's indulgence, I would like to go to public testimony, and that may generate some more questions and possibly some answers. We have Bruce McGlasson online. Are you with us, Bruce?
Yes, sir, I am.
Would you identify yourself and your affiliation for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Yeah, Bruce McGlasson, and I am the president of Grant Aviation. We're a small Part 135 airline operating primarily in West Alaska.
And thank you. And go ahead with your testimony.
Well, I just wanted to ask of you guys to provide us with some protection. I know that there are rules in place now that prevent the kind of behavior this bill addresses, but they're routinely ignored, whether it's statewide or just in our area, I don't know, and they are ignored with impunity by the attorneys practicing in those areas. The effects are not immediately apparent. To an accident victim on one of our aircraft, what we have found that the victims or the people on the plane that had truly suffered damages that need to be addressed will invariably contact an attorney almost immediately. And the attorneys are, what we also find, are contacting those persons that were on aircraft that suffered some kind of incident or accident that were not, I don't want to say they weren't damaged, but they can't point to a specific injury or economic damage. And so the attorneys are like racing to them immediately after the accident to sign them up, because if they go home and think it over for a few days, they are unharmed. They have no physical injuries or no economic damages, lost work or medical expenses or the like. And I would just like a cooling off period to protect us from that kind of behavior. One of the consequences of that behavior is that we are unable, the airlines as a whole, are unable to buy insurance coverage that is adequate for someone who has suffered truly horrific damages, an untimely death or a permanent disability, because our insurance companies are terrified of this onslaught of small suits that can only be described as extortive. They have a client that has no damages that they can point to, but they have signed up immediately after, and within a week of the accident, we'll get a letter from an attorney offering to settle this case for, $50,000 or $100,000, because they know that our insurers will look at the cost of defense and probably opt to settle rather than go to trial. And the consequences are horrible for us. Our insurance rates have more than doubled in the last 5 or 6 years, or tripled in some cases. And our available coverage has been dropped in some cases. We are fortunate. We're able to insure our seats for $500,000 a seat. That was $1 million a seat a few years ago we could buy. Now it's not even an option at any price. And many carriers in the state are looking at limitations of $300,000 a seat because the insurance companies are afraid of the onslaught of suits that is presented to them.
Mr. McGlasson, do you have some actual accidents without infringing on people's privacy or whatever, where these events have occurred that you could share with us?
I would rather not name the people involved, if that's all right, because there are
litigation
in process.
Yeah, I don't want you to do that.
We in one accident, we had an attorney actually went to the hospital and waited for the people that were on the airplane to walk out the door after, it was an accident, but no one unfortunately suffered any injuries that required even an overnight stay in a hospital. And so the attorney goes to the hospital in Bethel and waits for the people to come out and gives them a ride home. Whether in a small area like that, it's hard to say whether he knew them before or was acquainted with them or did business with them. I really don't know if that's the case or not. But that type of immediate contact, and it's almost guaranteed to generate a client for him. Even though the doctors released the people 2 or 3 hours after the accident, just after they had a chance to look at them, we have suits now in place that they've offered to settle for, $50,000 or you know, small amounts by some civil suit standards, but added up, our insurance companies are you know, they're becoming less and less willing to cover us because of this kind of thing. Another accident we had, which was a much more serious accident a few years ago, and the attorney sent, it was a couple of weeks before Christmas, and so we had law firms sending letters to every single person in the village where the accident occurred, broadcasting them so as to avoid the you know, the rules of conduct law or ruling. But still, the intent is to find someone who has minimal damages or possibly no damages, but has suffered in an aircraft accident or incident, and they know if they don't get them immediately, then many times they will not sue because they have no physical damages or no economic damages. But when the lawyer picks them up at the hospital and tells them on the way home that they can make $50,000 or $100,000 just for, you know, for their lost night's sleep or whatever, then, I mean, it appeals to the need that many people have there. You know, I can't dispute their needs, economic needs, but to claim damages and to settle what, again, can only be described as an extortive action.
All right, thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. We do have someone here in Juneau to testify as well. Mr. Jacobson. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Jacobson. I'm president of Wings of Alaska. I'm also a member of the Alaska Air Carriers Association Board of Directors, and if our chairman isn't online today, I think I have the approval to speak on behalf of the Air Carriers Association. We're just here to support this bill. What Mr. McLaughlin offered is very true. Rates have tripled for many carriers throughout the state. Limits have come down. Some of us that used to enjoy $10 and $20 million smooth coverage are now being offered $500,000 a seat. And for those of you that have been involved with any aviation incidents or accidents over the years, $500,000 truly isn't enough to take care of the people that are truly deserving in an accident like this. And to address Senator French's concern, whether it was people inside the towers or on the airplane, in a situation like this, the Aviation Disaster Family Assistance Act addresses them as all together. It's an aviation accident, and so all those people are concerned. And to share with you, it's just the way it is. I don't know why it is, but aviation accidents, because of the calamity of it or the catastrophe, even if it's just one or two people, in an air taxi accident like there would be in an automobile accident. The settlements and the awards related to an aviation accident are usually 10 times what they are in an automobile accident. That's just the way it is. And as a result, our rates have to be commensurate. And so because we depend so much on aviation in Alaska, lack of roads, and I mean it is, a taxi service, it's a bus service for so many people up here. We air carriers are struggling to provide good service. At the same time, we're getting beat up and we're getting affected, in this case, by some people who aren't acting honorable in their profession. So we just ask for your support on this House bill and hope you can move it on, and we'll hope to see this move through. Thank you.
Maybe some deep pocket syndrome here. You can make a small fortune in aviation, provided you start out with a large one.
Questions
for either of the two gentlemen that testified?
Just one question.
Yes, Senator French.
Mr. McLaughlin, if you're still on the line, did you file a bar complaint against that individual who waited at the hospital to drive people home from the hospital?
No, I have not. It was a fairly recent occurrence. I didn't really realize that there was something in place to do that.
And when you say fairly recent, you mean like within the last 6 months?
Yes.
And any other instance besides that one?
It's hard to... In the smaller communities, like in Bethel, which is actually a large community for that area, everyone knows everyone. I'm not sure how... I can't tell which clients had former relationships with the attorneys or not. But in almost every accident that we've ever had, and from talking to the other airlines, the people involved in the accidents, the passengers have been almost immediately contacted in almost every case. I'm sure we could put a list of names and clients together for the bar if that's an option for us. It is the rule rather than the exception.
Yeah, I see. I guess I think that you should pursue the avenues you have, certainly, and you should always try to correct someone with the least amount of force possible. It's kind of like filing a lawsuit, I guess. If you can settle this, if you can correct someone's actions, try correcting them. Maybe this person doesn't know he's breaking the bar rule. I don't know.
Well, I'm sure the client doesn't know they're breaking the rules.
I think the point is, Jacob, I think the point is when a victim of an aircraft incident or accident has been affected, many of them really don't understand what is possible. And when they're contacted by a plaintiff attorney who says, I can get $100,000 for you because you now have a fear of flying, and that's happened to us. We had an accident in 1998 where nobody was injured, just like Mr. McClassen's example. People got a little wet. They got wet from their hips down. We took them to the hospital, as we do in every case, and they were checked out and they were released. There was no visible or admitted injuries, but one of the four, we took care of her hospital bills and offered her $2,500 to move on, and she said fine. The others retained a plaintiff attorney, and they were promised big amounts because they now had a fear of flying.
Can I ask you a question? Did the plaintiff's attorney contact those folks, or other way around?
I don't know.
So for all you know, that situation would not be changed one iota by this bill.
That is true. But the point is, these people ended up with less because the plaintiff attorney has taken 30% plus expenses, and in a situation like that, we're going to defend those as strong as we can, and the victims end up with less. And that's a shame, but that's what's happening, too.
Senator Seekin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that if this issue is already covered in the Code of Ethics, then there is no problem with those people who follow their Code of Ethics. If indeed there are attorneys that are not following the Code of Ethics, and then all we're saying is we'll put some statutory teeth behind you guys living up to your Code of Ethics, which I think really solves. I mean, there's no harm here to any attorney who wants to live by his own rules.
Have anyone else here in Juneau would like to testify on House Bill 549? Close public testimony. Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Thank you, Mr. McClashen. And knowing where this goes next, I would entertain a motion.
Just going to the overworked judiciary.
But highly talented.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move House Bill 549 as amended from committee with past fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Object. And if I could, just for the record, Mr. Chairman, thanks. I was not to make anything less of the good testimony we heard today, but I guess I was really hoping to hear from at least one person who'd been sort of badgered by a lawyer after a traumatic injury or a traumatic accident. I guess that's what I took the heart of this bill to be about, not so much fixing insurance rates, but sort of keeping a protective aura around a person who's been through a tragedy, and we didn't hear that. So I guess I'm a little bit on the fence about what the object of the bill is. Are we trying to protect victims, or are we trying to fix insurance rates? And I guess I'll just make one more point, because I know we're going to talk about this a bunch more in judiciary or a little bit more, and that is the way the bill's written now, the way I read it, is if I bump my head in an airplane accident and have to have two stitches, I've been injured, and 44 days later, a lawyer sends a letter to me saying, hey, maybe you need some representation. That person is guilty of a misdemeanor and shall be sentenced to pay a fine of $100,000. And I share your concerns, Mr. Chairman, that the court is going to boot this. Someone's going to challenge that, and it's going to get booted out, and you're going to be left with no direction whatsoever about what to do. And so I think this bill needs a little bit more fine-tuning. Thank you.
And I would say that I guess I don't view it as harassment, but seduction of accident victims. And I, you know, I would be more concerned about the harassment, because the person gets seduced is probably a participant. But in that case, Jane.
Senator Speaker?
Yes.
Senator French?
No.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes. So, 549 has moved on. That brings us to HB 419, the Seafood Development Tax.
I knew we couldn't get through a whole session without some discussion of seafood.
Here, here.
Representative Ogg. Good to see your smiling face.
Nice to see yours, Mr. Chairman.
And we will consider any remuneration you'd like to give us for getting you out of the House floor.
And this doesn't go to judiciary, does it?
Unfortunately, we're recessed until 6:30.
6:30?
Very unfortunately.
Yeah, I understand.
So
you'll
some
miss
other committees
Vespers.
Will have to be foregone this evening. So, Mr. Chair, members of the Labor and Commerce, Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, my name is Representative Dan Ogg. I represent District 36, which is Kodiak Island Borough, and the northern portion of the Lake and Peninsula Borough, which is Lake Iliamna and Lake Clark, very beautiful places in the state of Alaska. I'm here before you urging you to move House Bill 419 on and to talk a little bit about it. House Bill 419 is a product of the Salmon Task Force, the Joint Legislative Salmon Task Force. It came out of the Subfinance Committee, which I chaired. We had heard testimony from fishermen who wanted a way to tax themselves. This is a new thing. They've done it in the past, but they wanted a way to tax themselves so that they could develop their seafood products. Initially, the thought process came from Copper River. They presently advertise their fish, and probably a lot of people are familiar with the Copper River Reds that are the first salmon fishery of the year, and they're highly prized in the West Coast markets, and particularly in Seattle. And they were seeing some of the grants that they have that help develop their program starting to come to an end. Other areas of the states have gotten into this issue of marketing regional fish. Kodiak is working on a branding mechanism. They have a grant. The Lucia brand out west, they have been in a program with some grants and marketing into Anchorage and the late season reds, and the Cook Inlet folks have also been doing a very similar program. They're seeing the end of these grants coming. They want to continue developing their regional aquaculture, or their regional salmon products and other fishery products, and it's somewhat like ASME and marketing, but it's different. What these folks said was that they would like to have the opportunity to tax themselves either by a gear type, a fishery, or some mechanism of both of those, but usually permit holders. The mechanism that we put forth in the bill allows them to do exactly that. What we did do through the discussions and the formation of this created 12 regions in the state. We'd first gone and thought, well, just anybody could do it, but there became so many numbers that it would be almost impossible through revenue to administer this type of program. So we picked 12 areas of the state, and we said there would be one development association in each one of those areas. And the way the bill goes, it allows the first one, So if you were the Copper River Red guys and you have your little organization, you would apply to DCED and say, we're the permit holders and we really would like to tax ourselves and we want you to run an election amongst us. I think it takes 25% of the permit holders to make this request. Then they form an organization. DCED holds the election, and if 51%, 50 plus a half, vote in favor of the folks voting who have permits, then they're one of those folks. And what the bill does is allow them to tax themselves in the same election, and they need to pick a percentage, a half a percent, 1%, 1.5%, or 2%. And they make that selection before they go into the election. If it passes, then they have now decided that they want to assess themselves that amount of money for purposes of developing their seafood. They also have the power to develop infrastructure. If they feel like providing chillers to their members, this is a way to chillers, fish chillers, sort of like creating ice machines on vessels. Maybe they go together. Or maybe they want to have a cold storage at the airport so they can get their fish there. Sometimes you take the fish to the airport and the plane doesn't come. Then you got to take it back. So one of the areas thought this might be a good idea. They wanted that.